Back together again, you and I, Monday, December the 12th, 2022, on Connecticut Today. We kicked off a new week on the show with my thoughts on the latest controversial statements from, yes, a controversial member of Congress. Journal Inquirer of Manchester columnist Chris Powell called in for his monthly report on what's on his mind. And we also heard from Heritage Foundation tech analyst Jake Denton regarding the latest Twitter revelations. I guess, unless I'm misreading something here, the Republican circular firing squad continues. Look, it's one thing if somebody acts like an idiot. It's another thing if people seeing that embrace it. And, you know, just when, you know, analysts are saying, well, hey, all in all, yeah, the Republicans didn't have this red tsunami in the November elections, but they do control the House and they're only one further seat down in the Senate. Just when that happens, in comes a clearly erudite and wonderfully political astute person named Marjorie Taylor Greene to again make national headlines and frankly piss off probably middle of the road centrist voters that the Republican Party needs. What am I talking about here? Well, you heard it top of the hour, and we got a lot to get to today, but my God, I'm going to keep bringing this up until somebody physically stops me. Who voted for this woman, and why? The White House is reacting sharply to comments made over the weekend by Georgia GOP candidate Marjorie Taylor Greene, and how the insurrection on January 6, 2021 might have gone if she had been its ringleader. Oh, my God. Is she really this dumb? Greene speaking Saturday at a dinner hosted by the New York Young Republican Club. And by the way, you people in the New York Young Republican Club, did you not think she was going to say something like this? What are you doing? There are 1,000 other Republicans that you could have easily invited, from Ron DeSantis and Lindsey Graham and Nikki Haley and Tim Scott or Marco Rubio on down. You invited her? What are you thinking? So what is this? Was it the scenario of you really didn't want to hear a well-crafted speech? You wanted what? A wrestling? You wanted this to be like the WWE? I don't get that. And now Marjorie Taylor Greene is backtracking. Well, I was trying to be tongue-in-cheek. Ah, ha, ha, ha. Congresswoman, with all due respect, it doesn't work that way. I'm sorry. It doesn't work that way. Now, here's what she said. She said, quote, and I'm reading this from the CBSNews.com website. She said, quote, I want to tell you something. If Steve Bannon and I had organized that, she's meaning January 6th, if Steve Bannon and I had organized that, we would have won. Not to mention, we would have been armed. Come on. What are you? I'll ask again. Who voted for you? And I'm saying this as a registered Republican who'd like to see my party at least win every so often. And you folks at the New York Young Republicans, what were you thinking? You know, inviting her. Did you really not think that she was going to say something like this? And again, when you could have invited any multitude of Republican speakers who would have given maybe a cogent, funny, uplifting, hey, let's go get them in 2024 kind of thing. But no, you invite her, and she says exactly what people think. Now, I have no personal animus toward her. I've never met her, probably never will. She has been to Connecticut once or twice. Somebody asked me once, are you going to go? I would say, why? Why would I go there to see her? Well, I thought you... No! And look, even if you think... See, this is where you have to be politically astute. There's being loyal to your party and being politically astute are two vastly different things. You can be loyal to your party to a fault if anybody has an R or wears something red for your party, or you can be politically astute and say, yeah, I'm a Republican or a Democrat, but I don't like what that person said, and the people in my party really screwed up. She also criticized ongoing U.S. funding for the war in Ukraine. Here we go. You got these far-right nutcases now infecting the Republican Party, saying, hey, what about all this money we're sending Ukraine? So what do you want? What is your viable alternative? And, of course, she called on Republicans to back former President Trump's 2024 campaign. Oh, my God. Now, having said that, she can say whatever she wants. I'm not telling anybody to shut her up. That's not the issue here. That's not the issue. The issue is when you put stuff out there and it gets picked up in the news cycle, and I can guarantee to you probably 60, 70, 80% of Republicans are reading this today, are hearing the coverage like we had at the top of the hour, and they're just, you know, they're face planting. They're going, oh, this one again. Stop. Even another member of Congress that I've criticized, Lauren Boebert from Colorado, you know, even she got the message. She barely won re-election a few weeks ago, about a month ago. And even she came out and said, okay, it's time for both sides to tone it down a little. I'm kind of paraphrasing. She said, listen, I'm still going to stand but from what I stand for, but even Lauren Boebert said a couple of weeks ago, hey, we've got to just tone the rhetoric down on both sides. I read that and I said, geez, maybe somebody finally got to her. And maybe she gets it. Because, you know, you get these first-term Congress people who get elected and they think they're all, you know, all this and more because of all their Facebook likes and all their Twitter likes and retweets and Instagram, pardon me, likes. But again, I guess there are just some that are going to say what they want to say, and I'm not against muzzling anybody. But then you have to live with it. So what she claims was a joke, okay, I'll take her for her word on that. Maybe it was a joke. Well, is she so wrapped up into herself and still clinging to the Trump thing over and over and over? Is she still so wrapped up in this that she doesn't get it? And there are a few others in the same camp with her, but can you be that tone deaf? And again, yeah, I can see where she... maybe this was a bad attempt at humor. I want to tell you something. If Steve Bannon and I had organized that, meaning January 6th, we would have won. Not to mention we would have been armed. Would have been armed, Congresswoman, for what? Exactly. Oh, I'm just joking. Well, there are certain things you probably shouldn't joke about. I mean, I'm all for freedom of expression, and I love good comedy from family stuff all the way down to the raunchiest stuff. If it makes you laugh, it's good. But you can't tell me there aren't people in that audience, or there weren't people in that audience over the weekend who heard that and just went, oh, God. But then again, they invited her. And this is the New York Young Republicans, a state that almost elected a Republican governor a few weeks ago. Turned out to be a little more of a gap than we thought. But Lee Zeldin ran a pretty good campaign. So what do? Instead of maybe inviting him or somebody else, you invite Marjorie Taylor Greene. I'm telling you this. And I know a lot of my fellow Republicans don't like to hear this. And there are people in the state, you know, the same people that say, oh, Leora Levy's going to be Dick Blumenthal. Those people. Yeah. You have to understand something. Democrats never do this to each other. Okay. And I admire them for that. The Democratic Party, whether it's your local races, your state races, or your federal races, the Democratic Party, rarely engages in circular firing squads. They just don't. Not that they don't have disagreements, but they rarely, if ever, play them out in public. It just doesn't happen. But then you see this sort of thing on the weekend, and watch, this is going to be, you'll hear this almost every newscast now from this afternoon into tonight. Can somebody please explain to me the propensity of conservatives and Republicans? It wasn't always this way, right? There was always that 11th commandment, Ronald Reagan said, and it was, I'm kind of paraphrasing, but he used to say, thou shalt not speak ill of a fellow Republican. Okay, I understand in practicality you have to have some party disagreement. But does the party not realize? I guess this all comes down to the voters, doesn't it? Because maybe there are people in her district and in other districts around the country who will vote for the most extreme, the most out of touch, the most ham-handed and ham-fisted people on the planet. Like I said, vote for the scalpel, not the sledgehammer. We check in right now, as we are wanting to do once a month, with Journal Inquirer Manchester columnist Chris Powell, who never leaves any doubt as to what he thinks on certain issues. Chris, good afternoon, sir, and how are you?
Great to be with you, Paul.
Thank you, Chris. Appreciate it. Let's talk about your column that just came out and one that's coming out, I think, tomorrow. Your column for yesterday on the 11th picked up in, you know, various areas here around the state, actually for Saturday and Sunday, the 10th and the 11th. There was kind of a story, or kind of a low-level story, but I did read it with a little wonder last week, with the governor stepping in and kind of celebrating the teaching of Native American history in the state. And look, I'm all for teaching history. I think it's better to know more than less. But you had some interesting thoughts about this.
Yeah, you know, I'm skeptical of this Native American history course that the state education department's going to put together, offer to Connecticut schools. I'm skeptical about it first because we have a crash in the basics of student proficiency in Connecticut. You know, most kids are not reading at grade level. You know, most kids are not performing math at grade level. And that's the urgency in Connecticut schools system. You know, not that we're deficient in teaching one little aspect of history here. And you know, here's the governor, you know, celebrating the relatively trivial and ignoring the disaster. I was also skeptical about this Native American history program because it's not that I think we need to know anything that's not really already on the record. I think the purpose of this course really is likely to be to continue the impression of perpetual guilt that society has got to bear regarding the Indian tribes of 300 years ago. And I think the purpose of that really is to sustain the Indian casino privilege that we have legislated in Connecticut. I don't think anyone in Connecticut today needs to be feeling guilty about the tribal wars that went on between the Europeans and the various Indian tribes, you know, back in the 1600s. I mean, that was unfortunate stuff. But, you know, I'm sorry it's over with, and nobody alive today bears any guilt or victimization over it. The Indian history is available in books and on the internet if you want to know it, but it's just not the urgent thing we have right now. Basic reading and math are urgent, but I think the legislators who proposed this Native American studies course and the governor going along with it, I think they're basically trying to build up a support mechanism for the casino monopoly, and I just think it's kind of disgraceful.
Our monthly check-in, no month would be the same, would it? Without Chris Powell, managing editor, formerly Journal Inquirer Manchester, but still one of the best columnists in the state. We told you about his weekend column. His column coming up tomorrow shifts a bit from education to dollars and cents issues, and Chris is always good on those. Chris, overtime again, wreaking its head here in the state, and this notion that we can actually do something about electric rates you're writing about.
Oh, well, the state auditor's poll the other day came out with their third audit in 4 years, criticizing the state police for excessive overtime that's paid to troopers and even and dispatchers. The auditors inspected the records of 25 state police employees and discovered that 20 of the 25 were earning more in overtime than they were earning in base pay, and that 16 of them were working an average of 13 hours per day over 2 weeks. You know that is absolutely the recipe for burnout and inattention on the job. And yet, you know, it's the way of life in the state police. This has been going on for many years. The auditors have reported on it three times in 4 years. 2 years ago, you may remember, there was a famous incident captured on video. State police trooper was exploding into a crazed rage at a motorist he'd stopped in New Haven. And was screaming how he, the trooper, hated his job and hated the public and couldn't wait to retire. But it turned out that trooper, too, had been working excessive amounts of overtime and was burning out. Well, you know, why do they do this? They do this because the state pension system incentivizes the troopers to do this. The pension system bases a state employee's pension on the his three highest earning years. They take the average of the three highest earning the years, and then they pay half of that as the pension. The problem is that the overtime pay counts toward the pension.
Sure.
So there's this enormous incentive for state troopers to work more overtime than they're working in regular hours, in order to build up their pension, just as that, you know, trooper who went out of his mind 2 years ago was doing. Well, you know, this ought to be changed. It's easily changed in two ways. First, you know, you hire more state troopers. The state trooper force is, I think, a couple of hundred under authorized levels already. Mm-hmm. And secondly, you take the overtime out of the pension calculations to disincentivize the troopers from going crazy.
What are the odds that's going to happen?
Well, of course it's not going to happen because the public doesn't care. The special interests, the state trooper union, and indeed all the other state employee unions, they go by the same system. They care, and they are the ones who make sure their legislators hear from them. But it's incredibly bad management. It has been going on for years and years and years, and the auditors keep pointing it out, and nothing is done about it. Now, the other day, the governor announced that he's got a tentative new contract with the state police union. He hasn't released it yet, hasn't forwarded it to the legislature yet. He's hopeful that it'll be so beneficial to the members of the troopers union that it'll make it much easier for the state to fill the trooper positions, and maybe it will. But there's a better way of paying them than compelling them or incentivizing them to work so much excessive overtime.
And Chris, finally, one of the other issues you're touching on in your upcoming column is the constant teeth gnashing that we go in this state regarding our electric rates, which are ridiculously high. And I've talked about this on the show ad nauseum. But what can we really do in the end?
Well, I think what we really could do in Connecticut, we get our Democratic officials to put some pressure on the National Democratic Administration to stop pledging to destroy the conventional energy industry in this country. That is the bottom line for our rising electric rates. We can't get enough natural gas into Connecticut. One another reason is we don't have the pipelines that come into Connecticut. Our politicians would prefer to blame the electric utilities, but the electric utilities haven't produced electricity in Connecticut for more than 20 years. Mm-hmm. People are supposed to, you know, go into the market and buy their electricity themselves from the independent generators that are selling electricity in Connecticut. Of course, most people don't do that. They just default and tell the electric utilities, okay, you go buy my power for me. And the electric utilities provide what they call a standard offer. And most people take that, but they don't have to. And even in calculating the standard offer, the electric utilities are just taking prices that they get in the market anyway. They're just doing the shopping for lazy consumers. So this is not the fault of the electric utilities. It's the fault of government, which is impeding the production of conventional energy in the United States. And it's probably fault of state government insofar as it allows the electric companies to put together the standard offer. I mean, the state, you know, very well might just tell people, no, you've got to go shopping yourself. You can't have your electric utility do your shopping for you. You go out and try to get the best price. And maybe that would, you know, diminish some of the demagoguery that we go through every year about the utility companies.
And yet, Chris Powell, finally, they won't do that. They're too afraid to do that. But what they will do is do these kind of Band-Aid proposals year in and year out. Well, we're going to fund this program more. We're going to fund that program more so people can just, again, get by the skin of their teeth and pay these ridiculously high rates. But if you really want us to get to the heart of the program, don't look for us to do that. It's infuriating.
Yeah, you know, we are already having our Public Utilities Regulatory Authority really switch costs for electricity. The authority is starting a program that will give discounts, require the electric utilities to give discounts to poor electric users. And how are the utility companies going to pay for that discount, those discounts? They're going to charge everybody else more.
Infuriating. Chris Powell, Chris, thank you. Appreciate the time today. Good luck. Be well. We'll talk to you in the new year, sir. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Paul. Bye-bye.
Appreciate it. Chris Powell there, managing editor, former Journal Inquirer Manchester, and again, one of the few columnists in the States. Why I have him on once a month to lay it out, what the real problems are here in the state, the fact that, you know, whether it's education, whether it's the electric rates, whether it's overtime, whether it's state policy. Chris is one of the few guys who, you know, sounds the horns, bangs the drums on these things. Okay, if you're poking around the news, especially on the weekend, late last week, as you're getting here and there from your holiday stuff, you see this stuff with Twitter and the Twitter files. And you're probably saying to yourself, well, you know, what's going on here? Chapter one, chapter two, who the heck is Matt Taibbi? What are they trying to prove? Well, to talk about that is Jake Denton. He is a research associate, Tech Policy Center, from our friends at the Heritage Foundation, to try and explain this in plain English. Hey, Jake, good afternoon. It's Paul at WICC here in Bridgeport. How are you?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming on, Jake. Appreciate it. So we're now through, what, chapter four now of the Twitter files here being released by Elon Musk, their new boss, who a lot of people on the left don't like. And he has enlisted a couple of far from conservative people here to help him out, including Matt Taibbi, a noted traditional liberal journalist. So, Jake, what are we finding out here, if anything that's surprising or not?
Yeah, so we actually did just get number five, believe it or not, in the last hour or two here from Barry Weiss. But as you noted, he has essentially enlisted about, I believe it's up to three now journalists, Barry Weiss, Taibbi, and Schellenberger, the former governor candidate from California. And essentially they're combing through internal communications that are essentially the foundation of the current censorship machine, or I guess now you could probably say previous censorship machine at Twitter. And so the main focus as of right now has been the 2020 election cycle, under the guise of January 6th and President Trump. And they're really just kind of exposing the length to which these activist employees went to make sure that President Trump was taken off the platform.
And also this controversy about the Hunter Biden laptop story, Jake, that you and I or all the other millions of Americans were told, it's Russian disinformation. There's no such thing as a Hunter Biden laptop. Well, the New York Post had reportage that it, in fact, was. And for a while, Twitter wouldn't allow people like you and me or anybody else from any other side of the political spectrum to share that story via their platform.
That's correct. So the Hunter Biden laptop story was probably the first instance of a mass censorship event within Twitter. So when this story broke, Twitter was alerted by the FBI that, you know, this is coming. It's a hacked document. And you see in the Twitter files, essentially internal deliberations where, you know, some dissenting employees would say, is this going to set a bad precedent? And then, you know, you essentially had this basically C-suite level leadership team say, no, like, we're going to go ahead with this. And they proceeded to, as we all know now, make sure that you can't direct message the story to anyone. If it was posted, it was taken down. That could have resulted in a suspension or a ban for the user who posted it. And ultimately, they siloed it off from the entirety of the internet and made sure the American people didn't see it.
Jake Denton, before we take a break here, devil's advocate question I have, and you do hear this all the time from some people. Hey, Twitter's a privately held company. They are held by stockholders. They have to answer to shareholders. If they want to censor any or all of this, aren't they allowed to do that? What's your feeling on that?
Yeah, so, you know, this is the elephant in the room, right? Is this a exercise of their freedom as a private company? But I think what we're beginning to see here is that there was a great deal of coordination between Twitter and the FBI and other three-letter executive branch agencies to make sure that certain things did not get posted on Twitter. In particular, I'm anticipating that the COVID files, you know, when that eventually makes its way into this kind of PR release that they're doing, whether it be Barry Weiss or someone else, we will likely see what we saw at Meta, where the White House was in direct correspondence with the content and safety team at Twitter, telling them what can be on the platform and what can't be. And that is when we will start to have a lot of First Amendment questions. And that will really determine basically our future as digital citizens. What do our rights look like?
Jake Denton is a tech policy analyst for the folks at the Heritage Foundation in Washington. So, Jake, where do we go from here? Before we get into some other areas here, where do we go from here? Again, like we said, Twitter is a private company. We talk about freedom of speech, but when that when that axiom of America was laid down hundreds of years ago, I don't know if the founders envisioned something that a platform where you could say or write something and have it go all around the world with the click of a mouse or the tap of a phone screen here. Can we ever really expect pure freedom of speech on a platform? And should we, if people are saying racist and sexist and homophobic things there?
Well, I think, you know, the founders never could have imagined that there would be a term called shadow banning, you know, where you could put something out of the ether and then it would just, you know, no one would ever see it. They wrote the First Amendment largely with, you know, newspapers in mind. And then out of nowhere, we get the advent of the internet and all of a sudden we have Twitter and essentially everyone can be a journalist at this point. Do you really need essentially to work out of an office or to be affiliated with a news conglomerate to consider yourself a journalist today? I'd probably argue no. And so I think we do kind of need a little bit of a modernization in terms at least of our interpretation of the First Amendment that gives us a great deal of protection for freedom of speech on the internet. We shouldn't have to really worry about whether or not a journalist's story could be siloed off like the Hunter Biden laptop story. So I think that's the biggest thing. And then you ask about, these hate speech things, whether or not it should be allowed on the platform. I think Elon, when he took over the platform, was absolutely right when he said that, you know, all legal speech should be on the platform. that might make some folks uncomfortable, and it'll be a bit of a learning period because I think we've been sheltered to a certain extent in the current internet. You know, they basically play kind of the hall monitor, make sure nothing offensive gets out there. But it, really, at the end of the day, we need to view this as a public square. You know, if you could say it in a park and not get arrested, you probably should be able to say it on Twitter. And so I think that is probably the way we should view this.
Jake, in the couple of minutes we have left here, let's shift to another interesting thought here, interesting topic, TikTok. You know, a lot of people in this country or in D.C., particularly on the left, they wring their hands at Twitter because I think it's an easy target and nobody really likes, although I love the guy, Elon Musk, for the fact that he's a disruptor. But, you know, Jake, we had the leader, the director of the FBI a few weeks ago, Christopher Wray, come out to Congress and say, hey, listen, you're still allowing TikTok's use in this country. And that is a bona fide national security threat. Now, I know there's a push to ban it, but why do you think Congress largely, Jake, at least the perception is they tread very lightly, very heavy handed toward Twitter and Facebook, but TikTok, they don't like to say too much?
Well, I think it's important to note that the right has pursued a ban for TikTok heavily for years now, right? President Trump really went out of his way to spearhead that. But then if you look at the left, you know, there's basically radio silence. And not only that, they've adopted the platform as a campaigning tool. You know, we just go back to this 2022 cycle. We saw folks like Amy Klobuchar doing TikTok dances with freshman candidates. And I think that's really revealing. They were willing to put away their concerns about national security, about any of these things for electoral victories. And I think that really kind of perfectly encapsulates their political stance, right? They're less concerned about domestic policy that protects Americans or makes us a prosperous country and more just concerned about containing power.
You know, somebody in Congress, I believe it was John Kennedy, the senator from Louisiana, the other day, Jake, who said something, pretty perceptive. He said, listen, a lot of young people, I'm paraphrasing here now, but he said, listen, a lot of young people are going to be mad if we shut down TikTok. But he said, then why can't we use innovators here to switch on an American TikTok that's maybe not tied in with a communist Chinese government?
Absolutely. I think there's really no shortage of companies ready to go for it. The American alternative to TikTok, it's really just kind of an uncomfortable reality that we have to face that we were so blind to essentially a digital invasion that we let this entrench itself into our society. I mean, every single kid's device at this point basically has TikTok on it. It's collecting their biometric data. It's stealing our intellectual property. And we're just sitting here, you know, waiting for our lawmakers to do something when we've known the necessary answer since as early as 2020 when President Trump tried to ban this. So it's really just gotten outrageous.
Yeah, but remember, everybody is nuts because Elon Musk fires people he doesn't want to work with. That's the real story.
It's outrageous. Yeah, it's all theatrics, really. There's no coherent policy approach.
Absolutely. You're right, Jake. No coherence. We don't have that. Jake Denton, thank you. Research Associate, Tech Policy Center with the folks at the Heritage Foundation. Check out Jake's writings and others, heritage.org. Jake, thank you. Take care. We'll talk down the road.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Jake. Jake Denton.